Wisconsin, both public employees and private employees.
Tiffany's bill would close off about 4,000 acres of private land that's currently accessible to the public through Wisconsin's Managed Forest Land program. Tiffany says under his bill, the company could elect to keep the land closed for what might be a period of 3 years. The Managed Forest Land program gives landowners a break on their property taxes in exchange for public access. Democratic Senator Bob Jauch blasted Tiffany, saying he was writing private legislation that will benefit a single corporation.
He hasn't been working with woodland owners, property owners. He hasn't been working with conservation groups, sportsmen groups who have been involved in writing this law. He wants to write it to protect one company, and exclusively one company, that's never wanted to keep this land open for public use.
The move won't affect the nearby La Couturier Harvest Camp, which is situated on public land. Senator Tiffany has already scheduled a vote on his bill for Thursday. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Wisconsin National Guard has received its first request from a same-sex couple seeking benefits. Yesterday was the first working day that gays and lesbians in the military could apply for partner benefits. Major Paul Rickard of the Wisconsin National Guard says one request had come in so far, and the Guard is processing it in full compliance with the Pentagon's new rules. Wisconsin banned gay marriage in a constitutional amendment passed in 2006, but the state has a domestic partner registry that grants a host of legal rights to unmarried couples. This is Wisconsin Public Radio News.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from the Driftless Area Art Festival, September 14th and 15th along the Kickapoo River in Soldiers Grove, with 80 regional artists, local food, and live music. DriftlessAreaArtFestival.com. Support also comes from Beloit College, presenting a public lecture series titled Whistling Vivaldi, How Stereotypes Affect Us and What We Can Do by social psychologist Claude Steele from Stanford University, September 9th at 7:30 p.m. More at beloit.edu/arts.
Old Man River, that old man River, he must know something, but don't say nothing, he just keeps.
We will talk about the Mississippi River this hour and the significant role it has played in our history, culture, politics, commerce, and more. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. So do you live on or near the Mississippi River? Have you traveled to its banks? Have you spent any time on it, on a steamboat maybe? What makes the Mississippi River special to you and important to all of us? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. We are going to conduct a Mississippi River 101 class today with Paul Schneider, author of Old Man River, The Mississippi River in North American History. He calls the book a biography about the country's largest river, which runs from the tip of Minnesota to the foot of Louisiana. Paul Schneider joins us by telephone. Good morning, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Joy. It's my pleasure.
How did the Mississippi get the nickname, that nickname, Old Man River, anyway?
Well, I knew you were going to ask that.
And you don't know.
I got asked that just the other day, and I have to say, I was a little stumped because I haven't been able to find, you know, much reference to it before the musical Showboat. I think it was in kind of common usage, but I don't have a great answer to how it got that nickname.
So why write a book about the Mississippi River? What's your fascination with it?
Well, first of all, I kind of grew up as sort of a river rat. I didn't grow up on the Mississippi or even in the watershed, but I grew up on the Connecticut River, not far actually from where Mark Twain ended up building his house and living out his days after he left the Mississippi. But my mom is from St. Louis and my dad is from Wisconsin, and we were always going out that direction to visit cousins and whatnot. And when it came to, I was talking with my editor about, I've always wanted to write about a river. It seemed pretty obvious that the one to write about would be the Mississippi. And then in order to understand the Mississippi, it turns out, at least from the kind of perspective I was working with, that you can't really write about the Mississippi without also writing about the Ohio and the Missouri and the rest of the watershed. So it just became a big, wide project. But I'm pretty happy with the result.
Why can't you write about the Mississippi without writing about those other rivers?
Well, you can certainly write, you know, all of these other rivers and various parts of the Mississippi are worthy of books of their own, you know, and there have been some fine books. But if you basically above St. Louis, above Cairo, Illinois, where the Ohio comes in, is kind of considered the upper Mississippi. And that's the Mississippi of Wisconsin and Minnesota and where your folks are. And it is obviously the one that has the name all the way to the top. But it is the Missouri is actually much longer than the upper Mississippi, and the Ohio brings more water than the upper Mississippi or the Missouri or both of them combined to the big party down below St. Louis. So, you know, those three rivers together really kind of create the big Old Man River at the bottom. And historically, you know, it helps to particularly be able to also tell the story of the Ohio, because as the French came down the upper Mississippi, you know, in the early exploration days, but the colonists, for the most part, from the English-speaking colonies, you know, came down the Ohio and then went up.
Yeah.
So to understand the big history, I wanted to understand the whole watershed.
Yeah, and we'll talk about it all, and whatever our listeners want to ask, we welcome your questions about the Mississippi River and its role in our history, in our culture. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. So where does the Mississippi officially begin?
Well, officially it begins up, you know, in Lake Itasca at the top of Minnesota. And, you know, there was a lot of, took a long time to find that. It starts in 10,000 places, really, if you take the bigger picture. You know, it also starts up at the top of the Missouri, and it starts up in Pittsburgh, and it starts, you know, anywhere you drop some water, pretty much between the Appalachians and the Rockies is going to wind up in New Orleans eventually.
Yeah, it ends in the Gulf of Mexico, but it doesn't just dump out into the Gulf in one place. Describe the delta.
Yeah, the delta is really a very, you know, cool and fragile and wonderful kind of ecosystem. We think of a river typically as having a whole lot of places that it starts and going out of one mouth. But left to its own devices, the Mississippi would almost have, well, not as many outflows, but it sort of breaks up and braids out on its way out. Now, we've, over the course of 200 years, have closed up most of those so that it doesn't kind of trickle out in as many different places as it used to. But the main branch gets down below New Orleans about 90 miles, and then it breaks into three rivers and kind of goes out in what's called a Birdfoot Delta. And, you know, the delta is probably the most endangered piece of the river right now in a lot of ways. The land is sinking, as many of your listeners may have heard about, for a whole host of reasons. And then there's the Gulf oil spill, and then there's pollution coming from the river itself down in there. But it's a vast grassland where pretty much, you know, all that Cajun food comes from,
mm-hmm.
shrimp and whatnot.
So were you at the source of the river in Minnesota?
You know, I have been to the source of, you know, I grew up going to as I said, out to the Midwest a lot, and I went to Itasca as a child, but then I didn't ultimately get back there in this book, to be completely honest with you. I got up pretty far, you know, and I was up around Leech Lake and you know, and up and down Wisconsin and Minnesota doing explorations, but I did not, in fact, go all the way to Itasca.
Well, what Wisconsin towns did you visit during your travels and your research on the river?
Oh, well, you know, I basically drove up and down the river, so I was, you know, I was in La Crosse and in Prairie du Chien and, you know, visiting my cousins over in Madison area, although, you know, that's not on the river, but it's part of the watershed. And, you know, just driving up and down between Minnesota and New Orleans, I probably drove through pretty much every town between those places at some point. And then a lot of the book, you know, a lot of places I got on the river and was not as much in the upper river. The upper river I was more just driving around and exploring on foot. But my son and I did a fairly sizable kayak trip on the lower river, and I took boats down the Ohio and down the Mississippi to New Orleans, etc. So it was a really fun book to research.
I'm wondering if there's a big difference between the river, Mississippi River communities like, you know, La Crosse and inland ones like Madison. I mean, how does the river shape those towns that are right on its banks?
I have a friend from Minneapolis who he's written not about the river so much. His name is Jay Wall Jasper, and he said to me at one point, and then the more I thought about it, the more it occurred to me it seemed true that he felt that the cities on the river are more like each other than they are like inland cities, and I think that there's some real truth to that, and that's, you know, historically, because the river was this highway, it brought all kinds of different people, you know. So St. Louis and Minnesota, and Minneapolis, say, are kind of, you know, more kindred cities than you know, someplace like Columbia, Missouri, you know, or maybe Rochester, Minnesota, and I think it's because, you know, the river was and still is, but not as much as it once was, you know, a highway that brought a communities of people together, and so they were founded by similar people. You know, they often had a kind of rowdy waterfront and then a more sort of reserved population that lived up on the hill.
Talk a little bit about how the river changes as you travel along its length.
You know, it's funny, the beginning of near the beginning of you know, Twain's masterpiece, Life on the Mississippi, he says, I'll just paraphrase it, but he says, you know, the Mississippi is an unusual river in that it gets wider at the top and it gets narrower at the bottom, and it actually it feels that way. The river up north and where your folks are, you know, was carved into these beautiful wide valleys by the glacial runoff. The valleys are much wider than the river today could or would have created. So it's quite, and as you get down into the delta where the river's basically traveling through its own pile of mud and dirt, you know, it does feel narrower and deeper. The main difference that you notice now, or at least that I notice now, is that above St. Louis, because of the navigation locks and because of the engineering of the Army Corps of Engineers and the federal government, you know, the river is in most places not flowing freely. So it has a quality of almost feeling like a lake when you're on it. Whereas once you get below St. Louis, there are none of those dams, and the river really is kind of rolling along like we imagine a river. I mean, it's still completely engineered down there, but the strategy below St. Louis is not to build locks and dams, but to kind of try to guide the channel with various revetments and jetties and stuff.
We are talking with Paul Schneider. He is author of Old Man River, The Mississippi River in North American History. And we are welcoming your thoughts and recollections and memories of the Mississippi River. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Do you live on the banks of the Mississippi? How do you think the Mississippi influenced your town? Have you spent any time on the Mississippi? Do you have a favorite place along the Mississippi? Let us know. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. We are talking about the Mississippi River this hour. We're talking about the significant role it has played in our history, our culture, our politics, and much more. And we're welcoming your questions for our guest expert. We're welcoming your recollections or thoughts about the Mississippi River. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our guest is Paul Schneider, author of Old Man River, The Mississippi River in North American History. And Paul, you call your book Old Man River more of a biography than a history. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean by that is I kind of looked at the river almost as a character in American history, and I come to writing history not as an academic, although I did study history in college and a little bit in graduate school, but I came to become a writer of history books or books of history from a journalistic background, a magazine background, and so I'm always kind of more interested myself in sort of the personalities and the characters of a given story, maybe more than and the way that they can kind of enliven and show the bigger themes. But it's not, you know, so I guess we call it a biography because it's a person-driven story of the river.
Yeah. Well, talk some about the importance of the Mississippi River in our history. I know there's a whole book on it, but how important was the Mississippi River?
Well, you know, when I sort of embarked on writing this book, of course, I had a little bit better historical background than you know your average person, because I had written four books on various topics of American history previous to starting this book. But I kind of just had a vague sense, like all of us, of the Mississippi and Mark Twain and, you know, Huckleberry Finn. And the more I researched the book and traveled to many places on the, you know, in the watershed, the more I kind of became amazed, in fact, at how central a role the kind of struggle for the watershed and the river was to kind of the definition of America, right down to whether or not places like, you know, Prairie du Chien was going to end up speaking English or speaking French. I mean, the real conflict between the English and the French was over who was going to control the Mississippi and the Ohio. I mean, and then for 12,000 years before that, there's this incredibly rich Native American history that is really centered on the watershed. And then even in the Revolution, going past the French and the, you know, once the English do control the watershed, or at least the eastern half of the watershed, even going into the Revolution, the watershed was more of an issue for the colonists who were revolting from England than I knew before I began to research this. I mean, one of the intolerable acts of King George and one of the causes cited in the Declaration of Independence was that King George tried to stop colonists from going over into the Ohio and the Mississippi. And, of course, that was outrageous. And even the Tea Party taxes that the Tea Party, the original Tea Partiers, were revolting against were taxes that the English were trying to raise in order to fight Native Americans in the Mississippi and the Ohio. So it plays this huge role. And then, of course, going forward, the steamboat industry is kind of the first big heavy industry. All the various musical sources that come out of the river, you know, the blues, jazz, rock and roll, country, it's amazing. I mean, I could just go on and on.
Well, it's pretty significant. You even say that the river was important in the fighting of the Civil War. How did the river affect the war's outcome?
Well, there's many, you know, historians, military historians, who argue that really the war was in fact won or lost, you know, and lost on the Mississippi River, and it's kind of one thing that actually perhaps Jeff Davis and Abe Lincoln agreed on was that by the time the river became, the North controlled the entire river, you know, all the way except for, excuse me, I have a little frog in my throat. I'm going to get a drink of water.
Well, while you're doing that, let me remind listeners that we are talking with Paul Schneider. He is author of Old Man River, The Mississippi River in North American History. If you'd like to join in with a question about the Mississippi River, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Or if you just want to relay a story or a memory about the Mississippi River. Why is the Mississippi River important to you? If it is, 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We have callers, and I do want to get to them, but I also want to get a conclusion to that cliffhanger, Paul. Why did the river influence the outcome of the Civil War?
Well, if you think of the South, the Confederate states basically were the river ran right through the middle of them, and so Lincoln and his advisors wanted to control the river, basically to split Texas and the beef and the supplies from the Old South, and they were spectacularly successful at doing that. And it finally came down to this incredible battle at Vicksburg, where pretty much Vicksburg was the last place held by the South, the last place they could transfer goods across the river. And it was almost a medieval sort of siege down there. And once Vicksburg fell, the South's fate was fairly well sealed. Mm-hmm. And so the river, even though most of the battles that we remember are, you know, Gettysburg and more in the east, the battle for the river is considered by many military historians to be, you know, the key strategic battle of the Civil War.
Well, let's take some calls. So we have Marianne in Oshkosh with us. Hello, Marianne.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
Nice to be able to talk with both of you. 3 years ago, right now, my 25-year-old son and another friend who was 25 were in an aluminum canoe going down the Mississippi. They started at Lake Itasca, and about 70 days later, they ended up at the Gulf of Mexico.
Wow.
So they had an incredible adventure on that river. And what really struck us as he was checking in periodically was that what they had been most excited about was that they were going to see a lot of wildlife and just experience the peace on the river. But as they went along, more and more their stories were taken over by stories of people they met on the river. And the amazing friendliness, kindness that they experienced, just meeting people as they went along. For example, one father and son were canoeing, and they were from the area. They stopped to chat with them. The boy was, I don't know, 8 or 10. The next time they stopped camp, there, scratched in the sand on the shore, was a greeting to them from the young boy. Because he was just connecting with them. They usually cooked out, or really cooked out. I think they ate a lot of cold stuff, but you know, were roughing it most of the way. But if they saw a restaurant nearby, they might pull the canoe up and go in and eat. And one particular time, they both had two desserts because they never had desserts, you know, camping out, and they were 25 and canoeing all day, and they went to pay for their meal and we're told, oh, no, someone paid for your meal already. Oh, and by the way, somebody else offered to pay for it, too.
And it's wow. What a wonderful experience. And what is your response to this, Paul?
That's a wonderful story, Marianne. And I'm not surprised, having traveled a lot of the river myself. And there is on the river a kind of camaraderie and a kind of you know, brotherhood or sisterhood, particularly when you're on the river paddling or going at a human pace, because then people really pay attention to you. And if you run into somebody else in a canoe or a kayak, you know, you travel along with them for a while. And what's kind of fun for me about it is it's totally in keeping with the history of the river, where back in the day when all the settlers or loggers or whoever were traveling down the river to, you know, you're all going at the same speed, kind of at the mercy of the current, and boats would raft up. There's these stories from the 1820s and 30s of, you know, 15, 20, 30 big flatboats all tying themselves together, and they just become kind of a floating town that, you know, works its way down the river, and then people break off, and there's music every night with the fiddlers on the decks. And it is true that there, you know, of course there were also dangerous pirates and whatnot, but it is true even today that when you're on the river, and it gets to what Joy and I were talking about, how river towns are kind of kindred to each other even more than they are maybe to inland towns not far from them. There's a sense that the river ties people together, and people are friendly on the river. Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah, that song, Big Proud Mary, Keep on Rolling, you know.
So what was, describe for us what life on the Mississippi River was like in the days of the steamboat, and how important it was for travel and commerce.
Yeah, the steamboat really changed everything on the river, because prior to the development of the steamboats, which really kind of happens in the probably around the 1820s is when they start to become effective. Prior to that, it was pretty easy to go. It was dangerous for a lot of reasons, but it was pretty easy to go down the river. You just get on something that floats and go down, but people, a lot of boats, they didn't even try to get back up. You'd go down the boat, down the river on a boat that you built out of wood that you sawed and filled with apples that you grew or grain that you grew. And then when you got down to the bottom, like Abe Lincoln did, you just cut the boat up and sold it for lumber. You didn't even try to get back up. I mean, there were epic efforts to pull boats up and whatever. But once steam comes along, the river really comes into its own as a highway. And in fact, sort of particularly the parts of the Mississippi going, you know, up above St. Louis really don't even start to grow significantly until there is that ability to go up the river on steamboats. And then, of course, there's the art and the liveliness and the literature of steamboats that's just a vast and rich piece of American history. Yes. They were dangerous, however. They blew up with regularity and burned.
They did.
Because if you think of a steamboat, it was basically a pile of wood. You know, it's all a wooden boat, pine, and it's got as giant, you know, fire as they can build on top to create this steam. And so they had those really tall smokestacks that you think of on the classical steamboats, specifically to try to keep the sparks away from the decks, you know.
Yeah.
But they did burn and explode with regularity. So it was a mixed bag, the steamboat era.
I don't think I read about that in the Mark Twain books.
How
well do you think Mark Twain covered life on the Mississippi or about the Mississippi?
Oh, well, he's fabulous. I love Mark Twain. I mean, but he also is a bit of a raconteur. I mean, at the beginning of Life on the Mississippi, he says, "Well, the Mississippi drains all the way to Delaware," which is like, you know, the Mississippi's big. It does drain 40% of the America, you know, of continental U.S. But there's not anywhere in Delaware that goes into the Mississippi River.
Okay.
But his stories are fabulous, and they're, you know, they're accurate to the degree that he was telling it from a particular point of view and time, and they're wonderful. You know, he is part of a larger. There are other, you know, writers of the time. Even Melville wrote a great novel. Well, it's not a great novel, but a weird novel about the steamboats. I mean, there's a lot of other material about that time. But I'm not going to be the one who says, you know, Mark Twain got it wrong,
because
he might, you know, rumors of his death may still be exaggerated.
Right. Let's take other callers. Barb in Green Bay is with us. Hi, Barb. What's your story?
My story, and thank you for such a great topic, is both my parents were born and raised in Dubuque, Iowa, and so I'm 58, so years ago we made many travels to Dubuque to see grandparents, and my dad's sister married a man who just was enamored with the Mississippi and had a houseboat called Betty Ann, and so we had all kinds of excursions on the Mississippi, up and down on sandbars, camping out, just, you know, not even going anywhere offshore, but just fond memories. Dad would always share with us the Native American lore that he was brought up knowing, and ever since then, I think I've been enamored with, well, water in particular, but being attracted to all the legends and the lore of the waterways. And I agree. I think that the towns along the river as well as lakes are all kindred to each other as opposed to the closer inland towns. And that's probably why I've always been attracted to them. But as a child, I saw the musical Showboat, and I just thought, this is Dubuque, you know?
Yeah.
And my cousin became a barge captain in his later years, and then went down to the Gulf, I believe, a month on, a month off. So, you know, it's just in the blood, I think, when you live there.
Yeah, and you actually lived on, being on a houseboat, that's like living on the river, right?
Yes, yeah. And that's, you know, Pollyanna, these are all things that I grew up wanting to do because I grew up on the Fox River in De Pere, Wisconsin. So it's always been a joy to have those memories come to real life where you can, you know, build a raft and take it out on the water and do the Tom Sawyer Huck Finn thing. And it's just always been in my life, water. So that started it for me, I think, the houseboat on the Mississippi.
Thank you very much, Barb. Boy, what comes to mind, Paul?
Well, first of all, you know, I love that she was out on the river as a kid. And one thing that you know, I hope people come away from reading Old Man River, you know, reading this book, is a sense that this river is, you know, it's more than just a historical thing. It's out there and it's beautiful, and it's, you know, even though it's endangered in places, and it's dangerous in places, it's still this incredible asset that we have as Americans, and the people who use it, the people who do get out on boats, just love it. And then what's amazing in some of the river towns is they don't seem to pay any attention to it, and people have kind of forgotten about it. Interestingly, the caller was from Green Bay and also mentioned kind of Indian lore and the story. It's Green Bay is actually where the word Mississippi first kind of entered into European usage. It was,
how
it
so?
Was there that the French began to hear about this river over to the west called Mississippi. And it was there, it was from Green Bay that they first, you know, went, Joliet and others first went over and got on the Wisconsin River and then down to the Mississippi. So it's connected that way, too.
What does Mississippi mean?
You know, it does not mean father of waters.
Mm-hmm.
It basically, the best translation, and it's kind of an Algonquin or Ho-Chunk word, it means big long river, which is an accurate title for it.
That's pretty accurate. Yeah.
And Ohio appears to mean beautiful river, but it's, you know, they're all kind of one river in some ways to most of the Native American languages. You know, just people didn't necessarily travel as far back then, obviously, for the most part. So. But it was just a descriptive word. Mississippi means, you know, big long. There's a big river over there. And the French were hopeful that it went to the Pacific. They became obsessed with finding the Mississippi and following it down to its mouth, which they hoped would actually be on the Pacific.
Well, it was close, I guess. Not quite. Ann on Facebook says, I grew up in a small town right on the Mississippi, and I always love seeing the Mississippi when I visit my parents. One of my favorite smells is the river smell, which is a combination of fish and mud, which my in-laws hate and think I'm crazy. So do you love that river smell, Paul?
You know, I do love that river smell, and it's very distinct. It's the big river smell, anyway. And it is a combination of fish and mud, I guess. And surprisingly for me, because now, you know, even though I grew up near a river, I live on the coast. Surprisingly to me, when you get on the really bigger parts of the Mississippi, when it's down low and it's picked up water from all over, it almost smells more to me like the ocean than it does like, you know, sort of fresh water, or than like Lake Itasca might smell. You know, it's got this musky kind of, I don't know. It's a very particular smell, and I love it too, but other people don't.
We are talking about the Mississippi River, stretching from Minnesota to New Orleans. The Mississippi is the country's largest river and has played a pivotal role in our country's politics and commerce and culture for thousands of years. We are talking with Paul Schneider. He is author of Old Man River, The Mississippi River in North American History. We're welcoming your questions of any sort regarding the Mississippi. And we're also looking for your stories, your memories of the Mississippi River. How important is the Mississippi River to you? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. We will take more of your calls now for Paul Schneider, author of Old Man River, The Mississippi River in North American History, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Erica in Madison is with us next. Hi, Erica.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What's your memory of the Mississippi?
Well, I actually don't have a memory. I would love to talk more with you and Paul. I will actually be traveling down the Mississippi River this fall with a group of 10 other people out of Minneapolis, Minnesota. We will be starting in Lake Itasca and traveling all the way down to New Orleans. So,
wow, that's fun.
Yeah, we're very excited. We're still in the a bit overwhelmed phase, but we're starting to get more excited. We're leaving on September 18th, and our group is called Paddle Forward, if anyone is interested in looking more into that. The question I have for you is, we're looking to get involved with the river communities and sort of hear the stories that people are telling on the river. And what advice would you have for people who really want to connect with, you know, the river, its people, and its history as we go down the river?
Well, I would obviously say read my book, but in a less self-serving way, you know, I would say you probably, there's two sides to that, because on the one hand, as the earlier caller mentioned about her son doing that trip, you know, you will just meet people, because people will see you and be interested in you, and you know, although it's a slightly different time of year from, I think, when many people do that trip, so there might be somewhat fewer paddlers out there. But in terms of the, you know, along the towns, you might want to call ahead and get in touch with, you know, the local conservation type folks. But on the other hand, that takes away a little bit from the spontaneity as well, you know. I found that you know, some of the towns are surprisingly, the bigger towns have kind of reclaimed their waterfront. And then some of the smaller towns, because they're back behind the levees, particularly when you get below St. Louis, you will find the towns are not, you won't even see some of them. You know, you've got to basically pay attention to where you need to pull off and then scramble on over to the town, to the smaller towns. And some of them are not doing that well, you know. because the river has, the river economy is so different. You know, the boats don't need to stop. You'll find a very different experience the further south you go.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's very helpful, but if you have an open, you know, if you have an open mind and an open heart, people on the river will find you.
Is like St. Louis, you can't miss the St. Louis if you...
No, you certainly can't miss the big cities. And they're wonderful. You know, they're a little trickier some cases in terms of where you're going to stash your canoes and, you know, and that kind of thing. It takes a little planning. I suppose if you have 10, you know, you've got a big armada with 10 canoes, so you're going to kind of have to plan ahead. When I did it with my son, we would just sort of, you know, stash our boats in the woods and kind of scramble on over into town.
Well, for example, I was thinking in Dubuque, there is the Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium, I think, is in Dubuque. And would that be a place that you might want to stop, Paul?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, you definitely want to, you know, most of the big cities have wonderful, you know, wonderful museums and kind of waterfront development. But it's, you know, it's the small towns that are some of them, you know, are really thriving. And I was just actually in the Quad Cities. I was just down in Davenport at the, you know, and there they've got the fabulous, you know, baseball Quad City River Bandits right on the river, and the city is great.
Mm-hmm.
She'll have a good adventure. I'd love to hear more. It's called Paddle Forward. Is that what she said?
Yep.
Something like that. So I'll look into that.
Thank you, Erica. Rose in Lodi is with us now. Hi, Rose.
Hi.
Hi, Rose.
Go ahead, Rose. Hi. What did you want to say?
I would like to, it's kind of some history. When I was very young, my dad cut ice off of the Mississippi River by Red Wing, Minnesota, across from Ellsworth, Wisconsin. And the ice was used to pack meat and stuff for the troops overseas during the Second World War.
Wow, that's amazing. That is amazing. Yeah, I've read about that. You know, but that's kind of great that your dad was part of that.
Yeah, it was, you know, at the end of the war, that's when refrigeration started, so then that, you know, put him out of a job. But, yeah, during the war, they cut ice off back when they used to deliver ice to the homes for refrigerators.
Right. Uh-huh. But, Rose, they would put this ice and food on a boat, and then it would, that's how it went down the Mississippi?
Yes, and they cut the ice off of the Mississippi. They used to have ice houses, and they would cut the ice and put it in there and with sawdust and that would keep it from melting.
Yeah, it's amazing how long it can last with sawdust.
Yeah, excellent. Thank you, Rose, for sharing that. How important is the Mississippi today, Paul, to commerce? And
well, it's immensely important to our economy. I mean, it's still, or has been for many years, and is, the busiest waterway, you know, in the world. And you get down, you know, the further down you get, the more commerce you see. But essentially, you know, to the degree that the United States is still kind of the agricultural powerhouse of the planet, well, pretty much 90% of our exports, agricultural exports, go down the Mississippi in some form or another, you know, on barges. So the river is still, you know, immensely important to us economically. And, you know, it's also still, it's not as much in the forefront culturally as it probably was, but it's, you know, it's still there, particularly, you know, New Orleans, you know, and Minnesota, and so the big cities are still, you know, vital. But in terms of the economics, really the important role of the Mississippi today is in barge traffic.
Mm-hmm. How endangered is the Mississippi today?
Well, It depends on how you look at it. I mean, it's very endangered in many places. The principal causes of the trouble are agricultural runoff. So in both at the same time that it's our part of our agricultural heartland, it's also the main source of pollution now in the river is runoff of pesticides and fertilizers and to some degree animal waste. It's on the other hand far cleaner than it was before the Clean Water Act in the 1970s. So, it used to be much, much worse. There are several other dangers to the river, which I write about in the book. In particular in Louisiana, there's a problem of the marshes just disappearing.
And why is that so significant?
Well, basically the salt marshes at the bottom of the Mississippi River are the largest salt marsh in the U.S., something like 40% of the salt marsh reserves, and that's where all of the young fish. I mean, it's incredibly important to the ocean. I mean, it's built by the Mississippi, but it's incredibly important to the Gulf of Mexico because it's kind of the nursery for the bottom of the food chain. And so, if it is degraded by pollution or erosion, or in some cases, it's basically due to the fact that we've engineered the river so much that all the sediment that used to replenish the marsh now goes out to the middle of the ocean. And the other thing that's threatening the river right now is ironically a sign of how clean the water is. It's this invasive carp, this species of fish from China that is in the river and is, by some accounts, taking over.
Oh, yeah. Those aren't the flying ones, are they?
Yeah, they fly. They're flying ones, boaters because they jump and they fly and they're not great for angling because they eat plankton, so they don't really hit a hook. There's some hilarious footage on YouTube of people having like a derby where they put on hockey gear and they drive their boats fast and try to catch the fish out of the air with, nets.
Right, but they're dangerous because they could take over the native species or whatever.
They are driving out the native, by eating the bottom, they don't actually eat the native species, but they are such voracious cleaners up of the bottom of the food chain that they outcompete. In fact, the reason they got into the river is they were being used in fish farms to kind of clean up algae and whatnot. And then during some of the floods, they somehow got in. And now they're mostly worried that they're going to get into the Great Lakes.
Well, Caitlin on Facebook says, growing up on the Minnesota coast of the Mississippi River and later moving to the Wisconsin coast, anytime I travel, people ask me where I'm from, and it puts a smile on my face. I say I'm from the Mississippi Valley, and you should be jealous. It's nice to know my family's roots go back hundreds of years on that coast, living off the fish. The Old Man River is a part of my heart.
Oh, so, I love that.
Isn't that beautiful?
That is beautiful. And it is a kind of a third coast, because it's as long as a coast. and it's that's a wonderful sentiment.
Yeah. Well, we just have a minute to go or so. You want to talk a little bit about the future of the Mississippi River?
Yeah, I think the future of the Mississippi, really depends on all of us. But particularly, perhaps, on the people who live by it, standing up for it and taking care of it, and demanding that our elected officials, whatever side they're on, pay attention to it, because it has been getting better for 30 years, but it's in danger, I think, again, of sort of slipping back into becoming a kind of neglected resource, and it's the most beautiful river in the world, by my humble opinion. And so, I hope that everybody gets out, takes a look at it, goes fishing in it, gets on it in a boat or a canoe, rides it down if they can, and pays attention to it.
I hope that you're going to be visiting Wisconsin or one of the Wisconsin river towns on your book tour. Do you have anything set?
The book really just got released yesterday. So it's hot off the press, and we have not yet figured all that out. But I still have a load of cousins in Wisconsin, so I'll be out there eventually.
All right. Well, hope to see you soon. Thanks a lot for being with us. Paul Schneider is the author of Old Man River, The Mississippi River in North American History. Thanks to Christy Taylor for producing and directing this program. Thanks to Bill Martins for on-air production. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come, including tomorrow. We're going to talk about wildflowers with a guest naturalist. That's tomorrow at this time here on the Ideas Network.
Weekends on WPR are fun and informative.
First of all, I wanted to give you a good visual first impression.
In San Francisco, we now have a sourdough hotel where you can take your yeah, I'm not kidding, a hotel where they will take care of your starter like your pet while you're away.
Good luck, Keller.
Wait a minute. Whoa, whoa, whoa.
You didn't answer question number three.
Listen on the weekends.